You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor, at gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with us again a personal friend of mine, a wonderful newsletter writer, just full of lots of wisdom and history and a lot of experience because, like me, he's no spring chicken anymore. His name is Richard Mayberry. Rick, thanks for being with me again.
Well, thank you, Jay, and thanks for the job you do on your radio show here. It's very rare to find somebody who is willing to step outside conventional thinking, and you do that very, very well, and you have guests who do that. And I personally, I appreciate it, and thank you very much.
Well, I thank you, and of course, the same goes for you in terms of stepping outside of the mainstream. You know, we're celebrating the 4th of July, and I did in my monologue today talked about how I'm disappointed in many ways, and I think that the founding fathers would be as well. The idea of liberty and the personal liberty, each of us are individual people, nobody quite like us in the world. Our founding fathers wanted each of us to be personally free, to be who we are created to be. And I know you believe that very strongly. That's why you're a libertarian, why you believe in limited government and free market economics, all of that. But you are definitely one of those. And it's, of course, it's no secret. I explained to someone who was critical of having the same guests on all the time that, hey, I have to go with the guests that I believe are in pursuit of truth, not necessarily what's going to bring me the highest numbers, how many, you know, how can I make the most money, how can I get the most listeners. But I have a core belief in and I know you do, and it's to pursue what is true. And I know you're very much that way, too, and that's why I really love to have you. It's earlywarningreport.com where people should go to learn more about your work. Right, Richard?
That's right. Early Warning Report. Richard Mayberry's Early Warning Report. There's actually, we've got a special offer going on now. You can get it for about a third off if you take advantage of that offer.
Excellent. Well, it's a third off of a price that's not onerous to begin with. So let me just tell my listeners, I hope that that you all out there will take advantage of Richard's offer. Richard, your letter is all about adopting to and profiting from the collapse of the federal government's empire. And your letter touches not only related to the general theme, but happily it also offers ideas as to how we Americans might actually protect ourselves and perhaps even profit from the insights that you provide in your letter about what is really going on as opposed to what the establishment would have us believe is happening. So I want to ask you, how close do you think the American empire is right now? I mean, you talk a lot about profiting from the collapse. I mean, it sounds like it's not something that's a nice thing to do. I mean, let's not profit from other people's miseries, right? But understanding what's going on is important to protecting yourself. And so this whole notion of the demise of the American empire, I think it's already, I mean, it wasn't to be an empire, but what we have now is nothing like the founding fathers suggested. But in terms of what we have now, how close do you think we are to some serious challenges?
Let's quickly define what we mean by the empire, and that is the federal government's meddling in other countries around the world and trying to intimidate those governments into dancing to Washington's tune. Had my researchers do some looking at that a few years ago, and they could not find any country on earth where the federal government does not meddle. And seriously, the federal government, usually by using American tax money to bribe other governments to dance to Washington's tune, they influence political events all over the world in every country. And there's just, ever since World War II, there's just been this slowly growing resentment of Washington's interventions in other countries. And it just gets worse all the time because their interventions get worse. An example that I've been studying quite a bit and reporting on in the newsletter that's really, really growing fast is Africa. It used to be the federal government didn't pay a lot of attention to Africa. Well, there are 54 African countries, and the U.S. government has troops in 50 of them helping prop up those governments. And every one of those governments has enemies, a lot of them, sometimes millions of enemies that hate those governments, because virtually all of those governments are the type that an American would regard as tyranny. Out of the 54 African governments, there might be two, let's say, that an American would be somewhat comfortable living under. The rest of them are just outright tyrannies of one brand or another. And the federal government helps prop up 50 of those 54 governments. And so by doing that, they are making the enemies of those governments enemies of you and me. And it's a horrible thing, and it's been the case all over the world for my entire lifetime. And when I was drafted into the Air Force during the Vietnam War, and I wound up in Central America in the 605th Special Operations Squadron. And our main job was to train and equip the troops of these Latin American dictators to help these dictators stay in power. Now, at the time, you know, I was 20 years old. I was really stupid about geopolitics. I had no understanding what we were doing, and I just figured they were telling us the truth, that this was good for America. But as I've gotten older and I've learned a few things, I realize that they were just using us for purposes that were very unethical and very bad for America. We were, in propping up these dictators, we were making America enemies of those dictators' enemies. Every one of those countries at that time, except Costa Rica probably, had some sort of rebellion going on, and we were there helping fight the rebels. And I realized today we should have been on the side of the rebels. We were on the wrong side in all of those. And that's pretty much the story around the world. The federal government takes sides with terrible, evil regimes all over the place, and makes more enemies for America. And the whole thing is starting to come apart. And that's what the so-called terrorism is all about, is all of these victims of these puppet dictators are just deciding they've had it. They're not going to put up with Washington's meddling in their lives anymore, and they're going to do something about it.
Well, so I would like to... I would like to pursue some of the threats that I think you've touched on in your newsletter, in your July letter, which I have in front of me. You talk certainly about China and the South China Sea. You seem to be suggesting that the U.S. is definitely losing its influence, its power in that part of the world. Would you comment on that a little bit?
Yeah. This idea that the U.S. government should be the monitor of the world, should keep an eye on everybody and make everybody behave according to U.S. principles, and to just generally dominate the world. That came about at the end of World War II. And at the time when that policy was adopted, the U.S. Navy had more than 6,000 warships. And it had easily had the ability to impose Washington's rule on anybody. There was no serious opposition whatsoever to Washington's power at that time, especially considering the Navy had more than 6,000 warships. We're talking about 1945. Well, today, The Navy doesn't have 6,000 warships. It has about 270.
Wow.
And it's trying to still pursue this attempt to control everybody. Well, there's no prayer. They don't have a chance of doing that. And, you know, the linchpin of the U.S. overseas empire is the aircraft carriers. And in 1945, when they adopted this policy, they had 109 aircraft carriers. Today, they've got 11. And they're still trying to pursue this domination all over the world, just to impose Washington's ideas on what kind of government you should have and how it should behave on the whole world. And it's just coming apart at the seams. It's a terrible mess. There, in the newsletter, I use the example, it's like watching somebody who's sitting in a bathtub that has, let's say, dozens of ping pong balls, and they're trying to hold all these ping pong balls underwater at the same time. And that's what Washington's doing around the world now. And it's hopeless. And what you've got, you know, the main focus of this is going to the governments of Russia and China, because they are the new military powerhouses over there, and they have decided that they're going to expand their own empires, and Washington doesn't like that. And so you have this three-way opposition to each other, developing this three-way contest on the expansion of their empires. And probably the most dangerous case is China. They, for thousands of years, the Chinese government controlled the South China Sea and the East China Sea. And as I explained in early warning report, in 1918, along came President Wilson, who just decided that there would be freedom of the seas, meaning that governments that own sections of ocean wouldn't be allowed to own them anymore, and that the U.S. Navy would be used to prevent ownership of them. Well, now that Moscow and Beijing are really big military powers, they want their territory back. Their ocean territories were lost, and now they want them back. They're going to nullify President Wilson's freedom of the seas idea. Now, nobody ever voted on freedom of the seas. There was no kind of legal backing to it until the U.S. pressured, I should say, until Washington pressured the U.N. into making up the freedom of the seas law that they did then. And so the U.N. now has this, as of 1982, this idea that there should be freedom of the seas, that all these governments should be deprived of their historic territories. Yeah, good. One of the really best examples is the Persian Gulf. The Persian Gulf was owned by Persia, which is Iran, for 25 centuries. And the official rule is, you know, the official rule promulgated by Wilson and enforced today by the U.S. Navy is that the Iranians shouldn't own it anymore. Yeah. It contains all that oil. So there's this simmering war going on all the time. The Iranians want their property back, and Washington won't let them. And it all came from Wilson's just wild idea that there ought to be freedom of the seas. So that's an example of how this empire is just coming unglued. You have the Iranians, and you have Moscow and Beijing and some other countries that are saying, well, no, you know, we used to own that. We want it back. Well, yeah. The Navy's only got 270 ships. What are they going to do about it? Right. So that there's a tension building here that's tremendous that the mainstream press isn't paying any attention to. And I think it's going to lead to something really horrific. And again, that newsletter, the July issue, refers to very possibly Japan being one of the places that's going to blow up.
Yeah, in fact, you sort of refer to Japan as being very vulnerable right now to China and to Russia and some of those powers, right?
Yeah, militarily, the Japanese are practically helpless. And I go into detail in that in early warning report, showing that the Japanese, the quality of the Japanese military equipment is pretty good stuff. You know, it's good, but they have very little of it, and they don't have a prayer against either Beijing or Moscow. They're actually military pipsqueaks compared to those two, and they certainly couldn't stand up against both of them at the same time. So the Japanese too, and I explained this too in the newsletter, that the typical what happened after World War II is the U.S. government told the Japanese government, you don't need to have a real military force. If somebody attacks you, we will use American blood and treasure to protect you, to rescue mm-hmm. you. And the Japanese took that to heart, and they never built up much of a military force. Mm-hmm. So they're pretty much helpless. And their people have been taught to be pacifists mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. To live comfortably under this American umbrella. They like living or hiding behind Washington skirts. Mm-hmm. And so when they go in the military, they don't see their military force as something that's supposed to protect Japan. They see the military force as a kind of fire department that helps people in earthquakes and tidal waves, mm-hmm. tsunamis. Mm-hmm. So their military force is small, and the troops may look good. They may look polished and all, but they don't see themselves as protectors of Japan. They see you and me in Washington and American soldiers and sailors and airmen as their protection. That job's being done by America, and they mm-hmm. don't really have to be serious about it. Mm-hmm. So they really are sitting ducks. The most important factor in military operations, the most important factor that decides between success and failure is the morale of the troops. If the troops want to fight, that's a whole different thing than if they don't want to fight. You can give mm-hmm. them the very best equipment in the world. They can be the most well-trained. But if they don't want to fight, they're going to lose. And the Japanese don't want to fight. Yeah. That's the key point right there, because Washington has taught them that it's not their job to protect their country. It's America's job. So you've got Beijing right there. You've got the North Koreans right there next to Japan. You've got Russia right there next to Japan. And Japan is this great big, wealthy, soft target. You add it all up. I mean, it's a grim situation.
Well, Richard, it seems as though in that way America has had control of Japan. We're defending them, supposedly, so therefore we can probably dictate a lot of other things in terms of how their policies, their monetary policies even, I suppose. Yeah. I wonder, though, to what extent the same thing might apply to Europe. We've been defending NATO, has been there to defend Europe. It's been funded largely to a great extent by the U.S. anyway, I believe. The same thing might apply to Europe. Europe has become sort of soft, easy life, great life, not worry about really defending themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, it applies even more so. The Japanese, as soft as they are, they're a bunch of Sergeant Yorks and Audie Murphys compared to the Europeans. And I give some statistics there in early warning report about, for instance, the German military and the British military and all. I mean, they could hardly fight their way out of a paper bag. Mm-hmm. There isn't a country, with the possible exception of France, there isn't a country in Europe, out of all the dozens of countries there, that is as strong as Egypt or Pakistan.
Wow.
And it's the same story. One of the statistics that I remember off the top of my head is the mighty German Air Force has 94 jet fighters. They only have a couple hundred main battle tanks. I mean, this is ridiculous. This is insane. These people are unprotected, except for Washington's promise to protect them with American blood and treasure. So, obviously, as people like Putin in Moscow are trying to expand re-expand the Russian Empire, they're bumping up against these helpless Western Europeans, and so this is a really hot situation too. And again, the U.S. armed forces are nowhere near big enough to handle all of these contests around the world if these people all decide to move at the same time. If you find the Iranians, the Russians, the Chinese, maybe a few others, North Koreans, all decide to move at the same time, the U.S. military will be helpless. They will have no chance of opposing all of them. And, of course, if you and I know that, then all those other governments know that, too.
Sure.
So you've got a situation here where we're all sitting on a time bomb, and nobody wants to admit it.
Right. Well, why do you think the U.S. is? I mean, is it just simply a matter of overextending our material capabilities? That is, guns and butter. We remember very well during Vietnam, we went off the gold standard so we could print money to expand the empire, to pay for it, to build the military, and to expand it around the world. But as you're suggesting, from your perspective anyway, woefully inadequate to defend the empire. So you're saying from a purely militaristic point of view, we're in trouble. I wonder also to what extent the financial aspects of our situation plays into that as well. I mean, how could we ever afford to build up things as you're suggesting we would need to defend the empire? It looks to me like it's impossible given the $1.2 trillion deficit Mr. Trump will inherit in this next year.
Yeah, I think it is impossible, and that's why I'm pretty convinced, you know, I guess you'd say as convinced as I can be, that there's going to be a military buildup that's going to be global. It will happen in the U.S. It is actually started in the U.S., but it will spread around the world because all these other governments now are beginning to wake up to the fact that they're helpless and that the U.S. government has lost the will to protect them and that doesn't have the firepower to protect them. And so they've got to do it themselves. So they're all going to, and I shouldn't say all, but a great many of them, they've started to build up their militaries, but they've got a long, long way to go before they can stand up against the threats like Moscow and Beijing. So I think you've got pretty much a global military buildup that's beginning, and that's one of the reasons that I recommend defense stocks so much, mm-hmm. and I have for many, many years, because the world is full of really nasty people, and there's a whole lot of helpless people out there that Washington has made helpless. And mm-hmm. Washington has plenty of firepower to protect America. There's just no possibility that anybody's going to attack America. The U.S. military is far more than adequate to protect America, but it is very, very far from able to protect all of the couch potatoes and wimps that it's created around the world.
Okay. So, Richard, we're going to have to leave it go at that because we're out of time already. I would just tell my listeners that there's so many things in your July letter. I read off a list of things. What Trump does not know about his foreign enemies. Is Donald Trump's trade war against China leading to a shooting war? I think you sort of answered that one. A new but unrecognized global emergency. A new oil crisis and how you can profit from it. Japan's risk, we talked on that, Japan's risk from its neighbors. The coming internet disaster. There's so, so much in your newsletter. Richard, I just want our listeners to take advantage of that 30% discount. And again, it's Mayberry, I'm sorry, the website, again, I keep forgetting, and I shouldn't, it's early morning report, earlywarningreport, .com, right? Okay.
Yes, and can I give the 800 phone number?
Yes, please do that.
Yeah, it's 800-509-5400. Again, 800-509-5400.
Excellent. Folks, take advantage of that. Really, I command that you do that because it's just very, very important. And I think also profit-making opportunities that Richard provides there as well. Very, very good stuff. All right, Richard, thank you so much for being with us. We'll hope to do it again in the near term. That's all the time we have this week. Next week, Jeff Clark will be with me, Nav Dhaliwal of Bonterra Resources, and hopefully Michael Oliver as well. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Bonterra Resources, an advanced exploration company, is aggressively expanding its high-grade Gladiator gold deposit in Quebec, Canada. Over the last 12 months, Bonterra has raised over $60 million and has attracted strategic investors Eric Sprott, Kirkland Lake Gold, and New York-based Vanek Gold Fund. Bonterra is focused on updating its 43-101 resource in the second half of 2018 and will incorporate up to an additional 100,000 meters of drilling, where the dimensions of the Gladiator deposit have been expanded to date nearly 500%. Bonterra trades in Canada under the symbol BTR and in the U.S. under the symbol BONXF.
Often referred to as one of the best teams in junior gold exploration, having discovered a 5 million ounce gold mine and sold a second company amidst discovery, the management behind Orin Resources now has a world-class exploration portfolio within Canada and Peru. Projects that give the company one of the largest direct pipelines for major discoveries globally, with one of the deepest technical teams to explore them. Entering into its third year of aggressive pursuit, Orin is expecting results from two of their major projects throughout the rest of this year. For the latest, head to orinresources.com and subscribe.